May it please the court. Evelyn Jeronic did not get full and fair review of her claim for nursing home benefits. Her problem took place on November 11 of 2007 when a claim was denied. However, the information that was furnished, and that would be at Administrative Record 1445 through 1448, did not contain the standard which was used to deny the claim. That really became somewhat moot because on December 12 of 2007, the claim was paid. The payment of the claim, however, brought up the issue which brings us here today. There's a gap in records from November 19 of 2007 through December 12 of 2007.
You know, I actually have a question about that, Mr. Kennedy, and it's this. Even if records are missing for a one-month period, how does that impact the ability to determine whether benefits should have been awarded where you have a record that contains ample, uncontradicted evidence as to the nature of the care that was received by Ms. Jeronic during that very time?
It depends on what standard would be used to evaluate the evidence. The collective bargaining agreement in this case is very helpful to us. It does have a predetermination provision. The latest version of the CBA is found in Administrative Record 5222. The predetermination provision is unique. It was not followed at all in this case, but had it been followed, there would have been ongoing determinations as to how long the patient would have stayed in the nursing home.
I'm not sure I'm getting exactly. Are you talking about the SPD now?
No, the collective bargaining agreement, the CBA.
I'm sorry, Steve.
Confusing.
No, but my ears are a little stopped.
The collective bargaining agreement has a predetermination provision that imposes an obligation to forecast how long the patient would need nursing home care. Each time that forecast is made, it must be done by a qualified person, and it must be done, quote, using accepted standards, unquote. The notice then goes to the patient as to the result. At no time was this CBA provision ever used. Had it been used, the standard that would have been used to deny the claim on November 11th and then award the claim on December 12th, both would have been mailed to the patient.
The plan argued that that argument was not made in the district court. Do you agree with that?
They're correct in so many words. At level two administrative appeal, I did copy part of the plan provisions which incorporated the CBA. I did point out that there was this obligation to make this ongoing determination.
Then how can we consider that argument now?
I would turn our attention to Honorable J.P. Stattmiller. There's an unpublished decision I did file with the district court. The case is Amich. I did mention the lack of full and fair review as one of the factors in the brief, and I referred to that decision. Judge Stattmiller seemed to think that the complaint itself did not have to cite 1133. This is another aspect of the failure to keep the records. I did complain about that numerous times during the administrative levels and also before Judge Breespot. The failure to...
Could you explain what you just said?
One of the factors I argued for reversal in front of the district court was that there were no records provided despite numerous demands from this time period, November 19th through December 12th.
No, but bottom line, the question I think is whether or not you raised in the district court your now argument is that the administrator's failure to inform of appeal rights and the failure to designate a length of stay.
And yes, I did that. I said they did not provide the records of that period of time. I don't think I specifically said that the CBA mandated the length of stay. The complaint, however, cited that provision. When I filed the lawsuit in state court, It referred to the predetermination provision and said they violated that because they did not look at what was appropriate for the patient. The complaint does have that provision in it. My argument would be that there was a requirement at that time, which would be between November 19th and December 12th, to have written down certain things, for example, the standard and the decision. Nothing was ever written down at all. This is not a case where records were written down contemporaneously but then lost. This is unusual because the records were never written down originally.
But, you know, we've got five medical doctors who reviewed the records, and each and every one of those five doctors determined that her care was custodial rather than skilled.
And they did that in 2009 under a standard, Milliman's, that did not apply, at least we don't think it applied, when benefits were paid. We're saying there's no way for me to compare the standards by which this information was evaluated, because the standards that were used to pay the claim December 12th had never been filed. That brings up a question of if there is an obligation, I think my light is on here, if there's an obligation to make a contemporaneous entry, as there was in this case because of the predetermination provision, and that wasn't done, what's the remedy? I'm saying that the regulations require other information to be furnished on demand. In this case, they should have restructured what they did and provided what they did do, try and resurrect that. That was never done, and for that reason, we did not get full and fair review. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Altman, good morning.
Good morning. may it please the Court, it appears to me that the panel has a good grasp of what this case is all about. Our review here is whether or not Humana acted arbitrarily and capriciously in determining whether or not Ms. Jeronic was receiving covered care. Five medical reviews said that she was not receiving medical care. I'm going to limit my argument very narrowly to plaintiff's claims on these documents. And in particular, he keeps referring to a period when claims were paid, and he refers to a December 12, 2007 payment. And what I believe the plaintiff's counsel is alluding to is, despite all these consistent denial of claims and despite these reviews that said Ms. Jeronic was not receiving care that was covered under the Chrysler health care plan, despite all the records that say there's no coverage, for some unexplained reason, on December 12th, Humana issued a check to the nursing home. No one knows why that happened. It wasn't supposed to happen. It was a mistake. But a check was issued. Humana recouped that money from the nursing home. But plaintiff, I believe, in reading his arguments and listening to him here, I believe his argument is because this check issued, there must have been some secret or undocumented determination associated with this check. And the problem with that argument is it's simply speculation. The document, the check, the plaintiff's counsel relies on says on its face, Humana automated remittance advice. Automated. There was no determination associated with this check. There was no determination on care. There was no determination on coverage.
Well, wait a minute. Some machine just said, I mean, I know we're in a brave new world, but some machine decided to just spit out a check.
A check was
spit
out.
I want to meet that machine.
I can't tell you how it happened. Humana can't figure out how it happened.
Well, there had to have been some person that directed the machine to issue the check, correct?
That I don't know. I mean, that makes sense to me.
Well, would the machine take it upon its own that makes sense. To issue the check? So who was that person?
No one knows.
Was it the person who was on the telephone call a month earlier?
No one knows.
Okay.
They've looked into it, and they've been unable to determine why this check issued. Significantly about the check,
you get control of your machines.
Well, and you can. I suspect Humana is very upset with the machine or whoever caused the check to be issued. The check was recouped from the nursing home. The important thing about this is this check is not the product an analyzed decision, of a determination, of an evaluation on coverage or the type of treatment.
But you can understand where Mr. Kennedy's coming from. Then what is it?
It's a mistake.
Let's say, assume that in this November-December 2007 time frame, somebody actually took a look at this, interpreted the plan documents, and decided that the patient was entitled to benefits under the plan documents and had a reason basis for determining that. If that were true, does it mean that you lose? Or does it mean that the subsequent decision denying benefits is arbitrary and capricious? Or does it just mean that, well, this individual in 07 decided to give benefits, somebody else looked at it, five other people looked at it in 09 and decided not to give benefits, reasonable minds can differ, and the arbitrary and capricious standard is still satisfied?
The arbitrary and capricious standard would still be satisfied. We would still prevail, even if there was an intervening decision that was contrary to other ones. In the end, we had five medical reviews that said that this was not covered treatment. This document is significant only to the extent that the plaintiff counsel says that there was a procedural violation under the regulations that documents weren't produced. And that's what I'm telling you. There's no documents because there was no determination.
So it's the nursing home that eats the mistake, right?
That is a subject of different litigation. So you're correct, Judge. I mean, at the end of the day, in terms of whether or not this claim should or should not be paid, it's not going to affect the arbitrary and capricious standard.
But what if the person in 2007 wrote something down that got lost, and that person said, I looked at this, and there is just no way we could ever possibly, rationally, deny benefits to this individual given what's going on? Wouldn't that bear on the arbitrary and capricious review of the 2009 decision?
It would be part of your record to review. I mean, you've got five other medical reviews that say that the care wasn't covered, and you would just take that into consideration. It would be six. You'd have 5-1 saying the care is not covered. The problem with this whole analysis is it's all speculation. It's just speculation.
What court is the other case in?
I'm not certain. I believe it was in state court in Wisconsin. I'm not directly involved in that. So that's all I have. If you have any questions, I'm happy to.
May I ask you, unless there are other questions, may I ask you about the plan document? Could you turn to page 6 of your brief, the red brief?
Yes.
And there's a block quote from the plan document on the top of page 6. And the second full sentence on the top of page 6 begins with terminal illness. Do you see that?
Yes.
It says terminal illness, and I'm going to put in some ellipses, under the program is a medical condition that requires definitive professional skilled nursing services. You see that?
Yes.
And then the next sentence says a covered benefit for a terminally ill enrollee whose condition becomes primarily custodial or domiciliary in nature, and the medical condition no longer requires continuing skilled nursing services, will not be payable.
Correct.
So the first sentence I quoted from has the term definitive professional skilled nursing services, and the second sentence I quoted from has the term continuing skilled nursing services. Is there any difference between those two things?
I believe there could be. I mean, definitive, as I read these medical reviews, and I defer to the medical reviews, that's what I think we should all look at because I'm not trained in these terms, but as I read those medical reviews, definitive means that the treatment is accomplishing something towards its goal. It doesn't necessarily mean saving, you know, at the end of the day. Ms. Jernick's case is a prime example. She was terminally ill. But the services have to be accomplishing a definitive objective, making the patient progress in the treatment. Now, you're asking about
continuing skilled nursing services there at the end.
I don't know that skilled nursing care necessarily means definitive. I don't know that they are necessarily the same. And I'm this is speculation on my part, just reading these medical reviews. These are not terms that that's why we've got doctors who review this.
The reason I ask is it seems that the first sentence I read for defines terminal illness as a condition that requires definitive professional skilled nursing services. So by definition, if you are a patient with a terminal illness, you require definitive professional skilled nursing services. And then the second sentence says, covered benefits for a terminally ill enrollee is not payable if the medical condition no longer requires continuing skilled nursing services. Well, so if definitive nursing services means the same thing as continuing skilled nursing services, then the second sentence doesn't make any sense because by definition a terminally ill patient requires skilled nursing services.
Two comments I had to hopefully answer your question. One is these terms don't necessarily mean what they would mean in normal parlance. Terminally ill, as we all would use it on the street, doesn't necessarily mean the same thing that this plan means, which is why they're defining it here. Secondly, keep in mind this is a collectively bargained plan. So the language is the culmination of the union and the company coming up on what they believe is going to be covered. Sometimes it's not as tight as it could be.
Well, if it doesn't necessarily mean what most normal people with some intelligence would think it means, how can anyone know what they've got under these circumstances?
Reading the plan. The definitions in the plan and in the summary plan descriptions and in the UAW manual. That's what the doctors look at, the people who are doing these reviews, the people who are administering this care. That's what they look at to determine what's covered.
Well, you're the lawyer. What do these things mean?
Well, they're throughout my brief explaining the various definitions.
But you're not explaining it right now, and right now is really important to you.
Okay. What would you like for me to explain specifically?
I'd like you to explain why it doesn't necessarily mean what it says.
Oh. All I meant by that, Judge, is the sentence that says terminal illness under this program is, and it goes on to define medical condition that becomes morbid. I don't know that that definition is what most people on the street would think it means.
Right. His time's up, but may I ask
of
another
course.
Question?
Of course, we'll keep him here
okay.
for 2 days.
Okay, is the bottom line of the plan that because the care was primarily domiciliary and custodial, that there were no benefits?
That's it. That's
okay,
correct.
If you could go down to the second to the last bullet point on page 6. It defines domiciliary and custodial care. Do you see that?
Yes.
And it says the domiciliary and custodial care is the provision, et cetera, and then towards the bottom, to an enrollee who does not require definitive medical or skilled nursing services. You see that?
Yes.
So in order to be considered getting domiciliary or custodial services, it means that you don't require definitive medical, skilled, or nursing services, right?
Let me read that carefully.
Okay.
I think I agree with you. Domiciliary care means that they're not receiving definitive or skilled nursing services.
And the patient here was terminally ill, right?
That's what the briefs say.
Right. And up on the top of page 6, it says if you're the definition of terminally ill is that you require definitive professional skilled nursing services. So by definition, doesn't that, because the patient was terminally ill, because if you're terminally ill, it means that you require definitive professional skilled nursing services, and if you, in order to be getting primarily domiciliary or custodial services, it does not require definitive medical or skilled nursing services, doesn't that mean by definition that this patient was not getting primarily domiciliary or custodial services?
No, by definition, she was not receiving skilled nursing. I mean, that's what all of the medical reviews determined, was that the care she actually received was not skilled nursing care. Now, whether or not we use the word terminal, I think when we use terminal, I mean, I agree, it's in the briefs, and some of the other documents I've seen use that term. I interpreted that to mean that they thought she was going to die. There was nothing that was going to stop her from dying. Now, how that tracks, that's why I was saying that there might be a difference in what you and I say is terminal compared to what's in these definitions. The fact of the matter is, every medical doctor who looked at this said it was not skilled nursing care that she received. She didn't receive skilled nursing care. That's what the plan pays for. That's what it covers.
I think that makes sense had the plan been written in a way that conveyed that, but the way the plan was written is that if you are considered terminally ill, and I think we all agree that this patient was terminally ill, by definition, you require definitive professional skilled nursing services. And if you require definitive skilled nursing services, then you're not, by definition, getting primarily domiciliary or custodial care, and therefore you're covered.
Well, there are other provisions in here that talk about if the care you're receiving, you know, it talks about the number of treatments you receive, and even though you're in a skilled nursing facility, that doesn't mean that you're receiving skilled nursing care. I mean, there are numerous other provisions in here, in the summary plan positions, summary plan descriptions, and in the UAW manual that talk about what will and won't be paid for in terms of convalescent
care. So you have the patient coming and you have the patient going because you have different provisions here and different provisions there. And then you get to choose which provision applies. Is that the idea?
No, it's the idea is that the reviewer, Humana, sent all of these things to medical reviewers, doctors who can understand the treatment, to look at these standards, to look at the medical records, and determine out whether or not this should be covered. This isn't the people making these decisions are not lawyers second-guessing what this means in the grand scheme of medical treatment. You have the medical
doctors. But after all that's done, then we all come to court.
Well, that's
and
true.
Then the doctors, you know, have their view, and then the judges have their view.
That's fair.
It doesn't stop with the doctors, does it?
That's fair, Judge. That's very fair. I suspect that's why we have the arbitrary and capricious standard of review.
But let's say the plan, and I promise I'll stop in a second. Let's say the plan says, if X, it's covered. And then another part of the plan says, if X, it's not covered. Does that mean that any decision by the plan is not arbitrary and capricious automatically, or does it mean that any decision, because the plan document is at war with itself, does it mean that any decision is arbitrary and capricious?
I would say that if the plan document is inconsistent with itself, it doesn't automatically mean one way or the other. The courts would look at the circumstances. They would look at the other documentation. They would look at the SPDs. In this case, the UAW manual is also available. And you would make a decision of whether or not, given what you're saying, I don't agree with you that there's a conflict in the plan, but if there were a conflict in the plan, you would look at, okay, take that into consideration, take the other documents at review. Now, when the administrator looks at the totality of it, was their determination arbitrary and capricious?
So why isn't there a conflict? A few moments ago, you said there are these provisions, and then there are these provisions, and the provisions don't always seem to gel.
No, I don't agree. I don't have all the provisions out here, and you have to march all through them. We've done that at length in the brief. The judge was asking me to read through a particular paragraph and talk about terminal ailments in the context of how it might be used on the street. That's all I was trying to address. Thank you, Judge.
Come on up, Mr. Kennedy. You've got 5 minutes, right? 4 minutes. But you can take a little more because we gave Mr. Altman more time. But only if you need it.
Thank you. We do have an opinion from the treating doctor that explains the situation the patient was in. It talks about being a complex medical patient on 14 medications, had some pretty severe ailments, which would be an administrative record 296 and 297. So we do have an opinion from a doctor, Dr. Rebecca Perry, that explains the patient's condition. The collective bargaining agreement talks about discharging someone to an appropriate setting. In this particular case, Barbara Becker took care of her mother for 8 years and no longer could do that, so therefore had to leave home. There is no other facility within 100 miles that arguably could take care of a person with these needs. So there is no place to transfer her to. It would not be appropriate to take her out of the home. I did talk about the definitive care. The only meaning I thought it could have would be that if it prolonged a person's life, it's medically necessary to do that. The care did prolong the person's life from a life expectancy of 1 year to 2 years, so it is definitive. That definition was rejected by all of the doctors and the plan. There is no case like this that I found where records were required to have been written down. They claim they made a mistake, apparently, in issuing the check. There is also an explanation of benefits for that check. I find it hard to believe that was done automatically without somebody being involved. The collective bargaining agreement does mandate that with predetermination there's an ongoing responsibility to make records.
Are you involved in the other case, wherever it may be?
I can tell you what happened to that case, if you're interested.
Well, I think it might be helpful, even though it's not of record in this case.
Actually, it is of record. I did file an opinion as one of the affidavits. I think there's five I had in the lower court. What happened was that there was a lawsuit with a nursing home to get their money back from Humana. Humana removed it to the federal court, and then the federal judge, Griesbach, removed it back to state court. And that ruling is on file here. So there was a case between those parties. I personally was not involved in that. I do know what happened to it. It was resolved.
It was settled. Is that what you're saying?
I don't know if the terms are confidential or not, but I know that it was resolved. I may not be able to tell you what the settlement is. I don't know if that's confidential or not.
It's over.
Well,
that portion of the case is over.
Yeah, there was an agreement that, again, I don't know if I can tell you what that is because they may or may not be confidential. I don't know.
Okay.
I guess I'll close by saying that in a situation like this where there is a requirement to have made the records from November 19th through December 12th, even if it was a complete and total mistake, they still didn't follow the collective bargaining agreement. With that ongoing mandate to contemporaneously have made the records, we look at that in conjunction with the regulations. I think it's 2560.103-1, pretty long set of rules there. Most of them are tailored toward providing records if there's a denial, which is interesting because in this case, there's a denial in 2009, so our rights kick in. But yet, let's say it was a mistake, where was the requirement when they sent the check under the regulations to have contemporaneously made any records of a payment? There may not be any. You may have a situation where at the end we're entitled to that information, but during that time frame the regulations did not mandate it be written down. The collective bargaining agreement, however, with the predetermination provision, does mandate that. So based on the CBA, I'm saying there was an ongoing obligation of writing those down. I'm saying that what they should do under what I call, quote, other information, unquote, that has to be furnished, would be to reconstruct what they did do. And if they're not able to do that, apparently they can't, then they have to pay the claim. Because when the violation occurs before there's any decision on the merits, the benefits were never validly revoked. I think I cited a case called Winner. I mean, you can prospectively stop payments, but by the time they looked at this in 2009, she'd already passed away.
Okay. Anything further?
I'm trying to think of what I missed. We might want to take a look at Dr. Tom James, who looked at this case on October 16th and November 2nd. And I think I mentioned Pannebecker, something from the West Coast, that relating something back in time, for example, if they try to relate back what they did in 2009, can they get it back in the calendar before November of 2008 and say that my rule doesn't apply, that there was a decision somehow predating this? And I talked about that, and I said that that in and of itself was arbitrary and capricious. I guess I could comment on it further if that's necessary.
I think that your time is up. I think that we thank you. We thank both counsel very much, and the case will be taken under advisement.